Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 19, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a Courthouse Steps decision teleform on Amgen v. Sandoz, an intellectual property case decided last week. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Gregory Dolan, Co-Director at the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Professor Erica Litzen, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law. I'll turn it over to Professor Dolan to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be a part of these teleforms, and I'm very thankful to the Federal Society for having me back and to Professor Litzen for organizing this and really spearheading this effort and joining us on the call today. So with that, let me introduce the case a little bit and tell you what kind of what struck me the most. And then I think Professor Litzen will get into sort of the more details of the case as she's, I think, somewhat more familiar with them. This case arose from congressional desire to make sure that some generic drugs, and for now I use this word in as broad as possible sense, and I'll explain why in a second, generic drugs reach the market earlier than as early as possible. Congress has already created a similar system to accomplish that for chemical drugs. So the drugs that we all know and love, your Tylenols, your Advils, your Propecia, whatever else, kind of the ones that come in traditional pill form and are synthesized from chemicals. And that system has been in place since 1980s, and it's known as the Hatch-Waxman Act. This case concerns a similar, although not identical, system, and not for traditional chemical drugs, but for biologics. And the biologics are, they're also medications, but unlike being synthesized from traditional chemicals, biologics are synthesized from biological materials. So they're, for example, your enzymes that, for example, somebody's missing you would produce. They are various other proteins that are, so this is the cutting edge of medicine. But just like with chemical drugs, biological drugs are also subject to patents and to various exclusivity provisions under various statutes. And in order for a generic drug to get on the market, much like for chemical drugs, they have to satisfy two independent regimes. First, they have to make sure that there's no patent protecting a brand name, so the pioneer drug. Because, of course, if there's a patent out there, patent gives the pioneer exclusive rights to sell, market, manufacture that thing that they have a patent on. And then, of course, the second regime that a generic biologic would have to satisfy is get approval from the FDA. And usually getting approval from the FDA is a very costly and very laborious process because you have to do studies, you have to do clinical studies, you have to make sure that your drug is effective and you have to make sure it's safe and you have to produce it in enough population. So that costs millions upon millions of dollars. So what Congress has done, very similar again to chemical drugs, is that it allowed the follow-on, the generic versions of biological drugs, which it refers to as biosimilars, because they're not actually identical unlike chemical drugs. They're very similar and they act in much the same way but may not be exactly identical. It allowed biosimilars to, instead of doing this whole entire FDA process from scratch, to just prove that they are, in fact, similar to the pioneer drugs and that they act the same way and they produce the same results. So the idea being that if the initial pioneer drug is safe and if it's effective, then a drug that's essentially the same would also be safe and effective, and there's no reason to waste the money to reinvent the wheel. In order to go through this abbreviated process, the biosimilar needs to also make sure that it would not violate anybody's patent rights. And so there's this Congress came up with this system, which a number of litigators refer to as a patent dance. So what happens is when the biosimilar decides to file its application with the FDA, it has to notify the pioneer drug on which is going to base its application and say, well, look, we're going to go to the FDA, we're going to seek approval. Do you have anything to say about that? And then the pioneer can respond saying, yes, we do have lots of things to say about it. We have patents, one or more or however many we do, and we are not happy that you're going to violate our patent rights, and so we are giving you a warning. And so they have to, the law says they have to identify a list of patents that they believe are relevant to this drug. And then the generics of biosimilar and the pioneer drug, they negotiate as to which patents ultimately and which claims are relevant and which they want to adjudicate right away and which they want to wait until the FDA actually approves the biosimilar application. So there's this first exchange of information. Then once the FDA approves its application, the biosimilar is supposed to notify the pioneer drug that they're about to enter the market. They now have FDA approval. FDA said that they can go and sell their wares. And once they're notified, and another round of patent litigation can ensue to the extent they didn't resolve everything in the first round. And so the way this case arose, so this is a lot of background. The way this case arose is that the biosimilar, the generic, did not provide certain information up front, thus precluding this patent dance from happening, because the patent dance can only start, this exchange of information back and forth can only start once the biosimilar does in fact give this notice in a timely fashion as prescribed by the statute. And so the pioneer drug sued, the biosimilar got its FDA approval, then gave a notice, and then the pioneer drug sued saying, look, you didn't follow the protocol, you didn't engage in this patent dance, and therefore we are going to seek an injunction against you from preventing you from going to the market. And the question the Supreme Court had to address was whether or not injunction was available given the structure of the Patent Act, this Biosimilars Act, which actually was it's a small portion of the entire Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the 2,500 pages legislation. And ultimately, it concluded that injunction is not available because the law explicitly contemplates what happens if biosimilars don't submit their application in a timely fashion. It has certain penalties associated with failure to comply, but not injunctive failures. And now, as I said, I promise to get to the point of what struck me the most about this case. Whatever policy considerations might happen, you know, that Professor Litson will discuss about whether this is ultimately good for innovators or bad for innovators, and I think there's, certain warning signs for innovation there and warning signs for how Congress crafts these compromises. But what really struck me is that one of the claims before the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, as well as one of the claims before ultimately the Supreme Court, was a state-based claim. The pioneer drug said that under California state law, injunction is available when wares are being marketed in violation of either state or federal law. And the argument was made that the biosimilar, because it didn't engage in this patent dance, violated the federal law, and therefore under state law, injunctions may be available. And the Supreme Court said that very well may be true. They didn't ultimately resolve it. They sent it back to the federal circuit saying, take a look at this California state law, see if federal law allows these, you know, whether it preempts state law or not, see whether failure to engage in patent dance is a violation, and if so, you very well might order an injunction based on California state law. And the reason it seems odd to me is because it seems extraordinarily odd to enforce a federal law that is Congress has always meant to keep uniform. It's in fact meant to keep it so uniform that it created a specialized court of appeals to resolve this dispute so it doesn't go to regional circuits. It seems very odd to enforce that type of law on a state-by-state basis, where an injunction may be available in California but not in Georgia, and a smaller injunction, like less the severe injunction, may be available in Hawaii but not in New York. It seems really odd. It also raises questions, what can California injunction be extraterritorial, because obviously both Sandoz and Amgen sell their wares everywhere, and those drugs cross borders. People can buy something in a pharmacy in Nevada and then bring it back to California. Can California enjoin that? So that seems to me to be a really kind of an odd way to approach the decision. I will be watching with a lot of interest as to how we'll ultimately get resolved on remand, because I think the worst that can happen is when both patent law and FDA law will devolve into this patchwork of state-based enforcement mechanisms, even if some states are ultimately adopt a policy that I tend to be more supportive of. I would rather it be a more nationwide policy. And so with that, I will turn it to Professor Litzen.
Okay, great. I think what I'm going to do actually is a slightly deeper dive into the provisions and the decision. So at a high level, the statute creates a mechanism for resolution of patent disputes between the pioneer and the biosimilar company. And at a very high level, what it boils down to is a private process in which the two companies identify the relevant patents. That's followed by immediate litigation on a subset of those patents, and then separately an opportunity for litigation on the rest of the patents in the final 180 days before the biosimilar company launches its product. The mechanism has, I guess, 7-8 steps that people started referring to as the patent dance shortly after the statute was enacted. And the entire thing is kicked off by one provision in, and this was all added to the Public Health Service Act, and a few provisions were put in the Patent Act, but the Public Health Service Act dance provisions are all kicked off by one provision that says that within 20 days after FDA accepts its marketing application, the biosimilar company shall provide, that's the phrasing, shall provide its application and information about its manufacturing process to the pioneer. And then the rest of the steps, where the two companies identify the patents and then figure out which ones are going to be litigated when, the rest of those all flow from that initial step. The way the statute is written, it's sort of 60 days after step one and then another 60 days after step two. And shortly after the statute was enacted, the biosimilar industry, many of the same companies that make generic drugs, started to put forward the argument that they had the choice to not provide the application. And the reasoning for this was essentially that the Public Health Service Act, in addition to laying out the patent dance, said if the biosimilar company doesn't provide its application, then here's what happens. And what it said happened was only the innovator could bring suit in federal court for a declaratory judgment, which would be basically a court's declaration that its patent was infringed. In the situation where the biosimilar company did not provide its application, the biosimilar company could not go to court and seek a declaration that the patent was invalid or that it didn't infringe. It was shut out of the courtroom until it launched its product. And so the biosimilar company said, well, it seems to be giving us a choice. We can do the patent dance, or we can decline to do the patent dance. And in that case, we're kind of choosing not to have this option in front of us. In this particular case, Sandoz was the biosimilar company, and they decided not to provide their application. And Amgen brought suit under a couple different theories, but one of them, as Professor Dolan said, was a state court theory. It was California's unfair competition law. And one of the things they're seeking is a court order, an injunction. What they were asking for in this situation would have been it would be a court order to enforce the obligation to provide the application. And as the case wound its way through the courts, there was a second issue that also arose, which was the final step of this patent dance, which provides that the biosimilar company shall provide notice to the innovator 180 days before it launches. And the courts said, and we're now talking about the final Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, the court said that notice can't be sent until the product is approved. what that meant as a practical matter is the biosimilar company had to wait. There's a 12-year data exclusivity period. It had to wait the 12 years. It would get its FDA approval, and then it would provide the notice, and then it would have to wait another 6 months while the pioneer enforced the patents that weren't part of the first wave of litigation. So the Federal Circuit said two things. It said that notice can't be sent until you have FDA approval, and it said separately that the patent dance, if you will, was optional, that the biosimilar company did not have to provide its marketing application. Both sides petitioned for review in the Supreme Court. Amgen, the pioneer, wanted review on the patent dance because they believe that it's mandatory, and Sandoz wanted review on this question of when exactly it had to send that notice that it was going to launch. Couldn't it send it 6 months before approval so that it could launch immediately upon approval? And the Supreme Court took both questions, and on the question about when the notice can be sent, the court said, well, actually, we don't think you have to wait until final approval. The statute says 180 days before launch, so any time that is at least 180 days before launch, that can be before approval. And then on the patent dance, what's very interesting about this is that when you go before the Supreme Court, you craft a question that is put to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, yes, we're going to review that question. And the question that Amgen asked was two-part. Part one was, does the statute require a biosimilar company to provide its application? And part two was, if it's required, do we have a remedy like the injunction, or are we stuck with just doing a declaratory judgment for patent infringement? And when the court answered this, they rewrote the question as, and I want to get the exact phrasing because I think it is very, very telling. And this is a unanimous opinion. Justice Thomas wrote the opinion, and then there's a one paragraph concurrence from Justice Breyer. But the way Justice Thomas wrote the question was whether the requirement that an applicant provide his application and manufacturing information to the manufacturer of the biologic. So in other words, whether the requirement that the biosimilar company provide its application to the pioneer is enforceable by injunction. And so he and then I've counted, he uses the word required or requirement 10 times in the opinion, and then the answer is no, there's no injunction. There's no federal court injunction available to the pioneer to force the biosimilar company to provide its application. And I think that's a very narrow ruling. And I think it's telling that they said the requirement was not enforceable with a federal court injunction. The way I would interpret that is that the court is saying there's no private right of action. And most of the statutes that FDA, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, implements, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act being the big one, have no private right of action. What that means is they have lots and lots of requirements that apply to all the companies that they regulate. But if you, a private citizen or some other company, is aggrieved by the fact that, I don't know, Sandoz didn't comply with the law or Amgen didn't comply with the law, you have no private remedy. You can't sue privately to enforce these statutes. It is FDA's to enforce. And my takeaway from this is sort of twofold. It is that we have to think about now what it means exactly to say that providing the application is a requirement of the statute. I mean, there's a footnote in the opinion. Justice Thomas has a footnote where he points out that it's entirely possible a violation, he uses that word, violation of this provision, could be taken into account in a patent infringement case when the district court is deciding whether to grant preliminary relief, which is a decision, I'm going to prevent you from marketing your product while the patent case unfolds. That this, the fact that the company had violated this provision might somewhat go to the equities here. So, you know, to me, that's a signal that the ruling is about the availability of an injunction for Amgen, and it doesn't say anything about what else might happen. And so there are a couple possibilities. I think one possibility is that the trial court could take it into account, as just mentioned. Another possibility is that FDA could enforce it. And there are a couple different things it could do. But one thing that I want to mention is that the Public Health Service Act, this provision, this section of the statute, has a criminal enforcement mechanism. All of this appears in Section 262 of the Public Health Service Act. The patent dance is subsection L. Subsection F makes it a misdemeanor to violate, the word that Justice Thomas used, any of the provisions of Section 262. So that's another possibility. And then the final question is this question about a remedy under state law. And as Professor Dolan mentioned, it's been remanded. California's unfair competition law makes it unfair competition to engage in an unlawful business act or practice, and that requires showing that the company acted unlawfully by violating another law. And then it has a provision that says that you can't get any remedies if the underlying law, which here would be the federal law, expressly provides that the remedies are its remedies are exclusive. So I think what's going to have to happen here is the federal circuit is going to have to determine whether failure to provide the application is, quote, acting unlawfully by violating the federal law. And then it's going to have to answer the second question, whether the federal law expressly says its remedies are exclusive. The answer on that one is no. But then they have to figure out the preemption question. It wasn't briefed below. And, you know, we can talk about it if there are questions, sort of how that would play out. I think Professor Dolan raises a very important issue about the complexity of a system where there isn't preemption and the relief might very much depend on what state you're in. But I think I'll leave it at that, and we can see if there are questions.
Great. Before I open up to questions, Greg, do you have anything you'd like to respond to?
No, I think Professor Litzen covered it fairly well. I mean, the only, I guess, maybe question or issue that I would raise, and it's certainly not her fault, because I think the court is a little bit speaking out of both sides of their mouth. I think she's exactly right. The court, speaking through Justice Thomas, does use the fairly strong words like violation and like requirement. At the same time, so the rest of the opinion treats it as if this were not a requirement, and this were, or at least could be read as treating it as not a requirement and not a violation, and kind of adopting the biosimilars position that this is indeed a choice as to do they do one or the other. It's hard to kind of to make out exactly what does the court think of this. Do they actually think it's an option with certain consequences if you don't actually engage in a patent dance, or is it a requirement and to fail to do so is a violation, just not enforceable by injunctive relief? I think Professor Litzen is right that there's going to be additional litigation over that question, but the way I read the opinion, just pure, not because for anything is exclusively said, but kind of for its tenor, is that the court does not seem to think that it is indeed something enforceable beyond kind of the patent and litigation consequences that flow from failure to engage in patent dance.
All right, let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. While we're waiting for our first caller, Erica, is there anything you'd like to respond to?
No, I don't think so. I think Professor Dolan and I probably have reacted a little differently to the opinion. I expect that difference of reaction will play out in litigation and blogs and articles in the months ahead.
But ultimately, I think we're at bottom, I think we're in violent agreement as to ultimate outcomes. It's just, like I said, what I mentioned is more of a gut feeling rather than anything that I can explicitly cite to if I had to write a brief.
Right, right.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask one of my own. Could you expand on what FDA enforcement after this case would look like?
Sure. So I think there's a couple possibilities. The most interesting one, to be honest, is this possibility of a certification requirement. And it was actually raised with FDA back in the fall of 2014. So it had been raised before, kind of informally in comments with the agency. But in October of 2014, right about the same time that Amgen brought this suit in the first instance against Sandoz, Amgen petitioned FDA and asked it to institute a certification requirement. And the idea here was basically, you, FDA, you have all sorts of sort of operating policies and procedures for when you will actually look at and start to process marketing applications. And typically these are things like, you know, it's not all in English, or it's missing this kind of a certification about this, or it's missing this particular form or what have you. And we think you should put in a certification requirement so that biosimilar companies have to include with their marketing application simply a one-pager that says, I certify that I will provide a copy of my marketing application with respect to the Pioneer within 20 days. And one biosimilar company responded to that, Momenta. They put comments in, because when you file a petition, it's a public docket. And Momenta came in and said, no, it's optional. The statute sets up a choice. You can either provide your application and do the dance, or you can not provide your application and take your lumps. And FDA denied the petition. But when they denied the petition, what they did is they said, hey, we've noticed there's litigation going on, and we want to wait and see what interpretation comes out of that court case. So basically, I think they didn't deny it in the sense of, and I think this is important because I think Breyer's concurrence, which says we think FDA has, or I personally, Justice Breyer, think that FDA has the interpretive authority here, they weren't interpreting it. They basically said, interesting question, we don't have to do it, so let's wait and see what happens with the court case. And I guess my instinct is that is the first and obvious thing. I don't know if FDA will want to do it, and I doubt very much they will on their own initiative do it, but I would very much expect to see the issue kind of ginned up again, because it was presented to them and they said, we want to wait. There's a court case. We see your court case. We're going to wait. So that's what I would think. I pointed out the criminal enforcement provision. I know it's been pointed out before. It doesn't get a great deal of airplay, but it's there. It's obviously not something either. I don't think the innovative industry has pointed it out very much, or very many of it, the companies have pointed it out, because if that could be applied with respect to the patent dance, then it applies to everybody, right? It just means a violation of any of those provisions is a misdemeanor. But honestly, I think either of those is a possibility, and I would think the certification is kind of the obvious one.
And just to add to that, I think a number of people, and maybe it is even you, Erica, who've raised it on in blogs and sort of in various listservs, the potential possibility of FDA saying, look, we obviously respect the Supreme Court decision, but we have authority to make our own rules and how applications get processed. And so as part of our rulemaking authority, we'll require applicants to do these things. And then the question is whether or not they would get certain Chevron deference on that, even though their rules may be in some disagreement with the actual Supreme Court decision. And so how that will play out, whether they would want to do it, whether they will whether that will be challenged in litigation, and whether ultimately that's actually a good thing. But that's another open question as to whether FDA can essentially overrule Supreme Court through administrative deference.
Yes, and I think, this is something that that Justice Breyer raises in his concurrence, and he's the only one signing that concurrence, but
right,
he's certainly signaling it's a possibility.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Tuesday, June 20th at 3 p.m. That call will be a courthouse steps teleforum on Packingham versus North Carolina and Mittal versus Tam, two Supreme Court decisions released today. That call feature Ilya Shapiro and Michael Houston to discuss both cases, respectively. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
I was going to throw out something if we're still waiting for questions. You know, one thing that might be worth talking about a little bit more is this question of the state law issue, and the preemption question, because it seems to me that if the lower courts say that an injunction is available under California's unfair competition law, then it has to figure out the preemption question, and the court even signals that it could go ahead and just do the preemption question outright. And I'm not sure how that would play out. I mean, there's no express preemption. I don't see an impossibility. So I think it just sort of boils down to this broader obstacle preemption that I guess that probably was what you were thinking, Professor Dolan. And I'm not sure where my instinct is on this. I think my instinct is that it wouldn't. If under state law, under California law, you had to provide your marketing application to the pioneer, then that would basically be setting the rule. I mean, once it's done, you wouldn't have a different rule in all 50 states, because once it's provided, it's provided. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm curious about your reaction.
To be honest, I haven't really thought very deeply about it, so I think I will hold off on reacting to that. So for now, I think it's just we'll see how the Federal Circuit is going to treat on remand, and maybe they will obviate the entirety of this question by saying that there's preemption and we don't have to figure out how each state will deal with it. So again, I'm not quite sure whether that's ultimately going to be good or bad for innovation. I think as a general proposition, I would prefer a uniform FDA and patent regime nationwide. But, you know, if it's a bad patent regime, I'm not quite sure that, you know, that ultimately would be good or bad for innovation. But how it's going to play out state by state, I don't really quite know yet. But we'll see. So, and I haven't really thought about this case from preemption standpoint, whether or not, you know, haven't really considered whether this statute does or does not preempt any sort of state regulation, kind of. So.
You know, in terms of whether it's good or bad, one thing that I think hasn't gotten a lot of airplay, it came up in the Federal Circuit, but it doesn't show up in the Supreme Court opinion, is what happens to manufacturing process patents. Because as it turns out, if the biosimilar company. Well, the short version of this is that when you look at the provision that says, well, the innovator can sue for a declaratory judgment, which is basically what you've given up, biosimilar company, is you can't get a declaratory judgment, but the innovator can. That provision says that the innovator can only get, or the way it's written is it speaks of the pioneer enforcing a patent that claims the product or a method of using the product.
Right.
It doesn't say anything about manufacturing process patents. And this was actually what prompted the very first thing I ever saw arguing that the entire thing would be optional. It was prompted by someone saying, maybe this is actually intended to allow biosimilar companies to not litigate the process, manufacturing process patents. And if that were correct, that a biosimilar company could kind of opt out and the pioneer couldn't enforce its manufacturing process patent until the biosimilar was on the market, I think that would very much be a bad outcome for patent owners. Having said that, the act of infringement that was added to the patent statute at the same time is broader. So I guess my inclination is that they can enforce their manufacturing process patents, but that's also an area where I think we're going to see some
And I think that's probably right, although, again, I haven't given a deep thought, but it's also, as I mentioned, worth remembering that this entire scheme is part of the Affordable Care Act, and as most of us know, the Affordable Care Act was is not a model of clarity because of a variety of political considerations and the way it was passed, that there are things that were perhaps were meant to be included, but for a number of reasons were not included, and vice versa. And so that could be, you know, that could be the reason why manufacturing process patents are not included. And of course, what the court makes of that, given the fact that they're not, do they treat it just like they treated, for example, the, you know, the previous Affordable Care Act case where they had to discuss what an exchange established by the state means, and so they rather more broadly than it's actually written, or whether they all stick to the actual language. I think you're right that subject to further litigation will it remains to be seen, but I think we shouldn't forget that this is a part of much larger bill that was put together under serious political pressure, had a number of holes in it, and so that could be at least an explanation. But it could be.
Yeah, it could be. Let me jump in and kind of self-disclose that I was deeply involved in negotiating this language from the time when the first biosimilar bill was introduced in 2006 until this was dropped into the Affordable Care Act and passed. And the patent litigation provisions, this language was written, negotiated and written before the ACA was being done. So I guess my own instinct, and having said negotiated, let me back up and say that I was representing the innovative industry, and these are the patent litigation provisions that were preferred by the biosimilar industry. And I think there are some drafting problems with them. Putting aside the fact that I think they're hostile to innovators, I think that they are there's some drafting issues, and this is one of them that should have been resolved. This lack of clarity about manufacturing process patents. But I think it was not a hostage to the ACA issues. I think it was just never resolved properly.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions from the audience. Would either like to make some closing remarks?
I guess I'm all out of thoughts at this point. I think it's an interesting, it's a well-written decision and very clear, but I think there's a lot of questions that still need to be resolved.
And I think I agree with that. And the question whether it's going to be resolved in the courts or in legislature or in administrative agencies is also something I think we have to wait and see.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.